Washington. This is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, remembering a slain Russian opposition leader. We'll have the latest on the Ebola outbreak, concerns over the rise of cholera in Malawi, plus in U.S. politics, Republican presidential hopefuls wooing conservative activists. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. They came by the tens of thousands, Russians marching under the national flag throughout central Moscow in memory of murdered Kremlin critic Boris Nemtsov. Young and old alike walked very near where Nemtsov was shot and killed late Friday while walking home with a girlfriend from a restaurant. Nemtsov was part of a small but active opposition that says President Vladimir Putin's rule has become an autocracy, flaunting international norms in the war in Ukraine and clamping down on dissent at home. Former Russian Prime Minister Mikhail Kasyanov was among the thousands marching. He spoke of his friend Nemtsov.
I was a shock. I was a shock because just to imagine that in the center of Moscow near the Kremlin, my friend and collaborator, leader of opposition, Mr. Nemtsov, was killed, was shot and killed. That's absolutely beyond imagination.
Kasyanov went on to talk about the way things are in Russia now.
We live in an environment right now when the society is split quite heavily in support of current regime and opposite. And therefore, we feel and we see more and more extreme expressions against liberal Democrats, against us.
Independent Russian political analyst Konstantin von Eggert says Nemtsov's killing speaks more about the dangers of operating counter to the government.
Being a critic of the authorities is nearly equal to being a criminal, in which violence is the best way to solve any problems, in which the society thinks of itself as a besieged fortress.
The Kremlin says that President Putin will personally be in charge of investigating Nemtsov's murder. Mr. Putin says he believes it was a contract killing, but there are some who believe the murder was ordered by President Putin. In Washington, President Obama called it a brutal murder and called on the authorities of Moscow to carry out a prompt and impartial investigation. Washington is getting ready for a visit from Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Will deliver what is expected to be a controversial speech before a joint meeting of the U.S. Congress tomorrow. The address, coming 2 weeks before elections in which Mr. Netanyahu is seeking a fourth term, has heightened tensions between the U.S. and Israel, which traditionally have seen themselves as partners on the world stage. We get more now from VOA's Scott Bobb in Jerusalem.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says he must address the joint meeting of the U.S. Congress, despite criticism at home and abroad that it is causing a serious rift in U.S.-Israeli relations. The U.S. and five European powers are in tough negotiations with Iran over a deal that reportedly would suspend Iran's nuclear weapons program in exchange for the lifting of sanctions against it. Mr. Netanyahu said Sunday that his trip is a crucial, even historical mission, and he is going as the messenger of all Israelis, even those who do not agree with him.
I feel deaga amuka vekena lebitkhonam shel kol ezrachei Yisrael legoral hamdina.
He says he feels a deep and sincere concern for the security of all Israelis and the fate of the country, and says he will do all in his power to secure their future. The Prime Minister earlier said it appears that U.S. and European powers have accepted a gradual easing of restrictions on Iran's nuclear program that within a few years could allow Tehran to make a nuclear weapon. He says he cannot accept this. Many U.S. politicians say the negotiations concede too much to the Iranian government, which advocates the destruction of Israel and, they say, backs terrorism around the world. The Obama administration opposes the speech, saying it comes during the Israeli electoral campaign and could be seen as U.S. meddling in Israeli politics. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry told the Congress last week that criticism of the negotiations was premature.
The policy is Iran will not get a nuclear weapon. And anybody running around right now jumping in to say, well, we don't like the deal or this or that, doesn't know what the deal is. There is no deal yet. And I caution people to wait and see what these negotiations produce.
National Security Advisor Susan Rice said that Mr. Netanyahu's insistence on speaking at this time has injected a degree of partisanship that she thinks is destructive to the fabric of the relationship. Israeli political analyst Akiva Eldar called the speech a political ploy.
I believe that Netanyahu knows what we know, that this talk is not going to change the American policy in regard to Iran's nuclear program, but it will definitely not improve the relationship with the President of the United States.
He believes the speech is aimed at drawing votes from Israel's right wing. On the streets of Jerusalem, opinions were as divided as among the politicians. Anthony Simon said Mr. Netanyahu should be allowed to speak.
I believe that America is a country that's for freedom of speech, so I think the Prime Minister has a right to say what he wants to say, like everybody else has a right to say what they want to say.
Shop owner Matti Simantov said the speech should have been postponed.
I think it's not good for us with the relationship with the United States. I think we have to keep to be in good condition with the United States. Our friend, only friend probably in the world. So we have to be very gentle with them. I think Bibi doesn't do that. I think he's disrespect them. I don't like it.
Jerusalemite Malka Shemtov said she does not believe the speech will change opinions one way or the other. She says voters believe that the prime minister is using the speech for his benefit, as he believes it will bring him more votes. But this is not going to help, she says. It's not going to affect the vote. Many agree that Mr. Netanyahu's speech will not enhance his standing among the opposition, but they say his tough stance against the Obama administration could help him with security-minded voters. Scott Bobb, VOA News, Jerusalem.
And while Iran's nuclear ambitions and what the P5 plus one want to do about them remain a hot topic for Prime Minister Netanyahu, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry will take up the issue on a trip which begins today to Europe and Saudi Arabia. Efforts to combat the Islamic State and rising tensions between the U.S. and Russia over the separatist conflict in Ukraine also will be high on his agenda. VOA State Department correspondent Pam Dawkins has the story.
Secretary of State Kerry's first stop is Geneva, where he will address the United Nations Human Rights Council and meet with his Russian counterpart, Sergei Lavrov. The talks come at a time when the U.S. and its Western allies have been urging Russia to fully abide by the terms of a ceasefire deal for Ukraine that calls for Moscow to end its support of Ukrainian separatists. Wilson Center analyst Matthew Rojansky says in the short term, Russian involvement in Ukraine is likely to continue to be an irritant to the U.S. and its allies.
Ukraine is really seen as a survival issue for Putin. That won't change.
In Switzerland, Kerry will also meet with Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif as part of negotiations on Iran's nuclear program. The talks come at a critical time. Iran and the five permanent members of the UN Security Council and Germany are trying to reach a framework agreement by the end of March. In remarks at a Washington think tank, Undersecretary of State Wendy Sherman, the head of the U.S. negotiating team, said the talks have been difficult, complicated, and tough, but the desired results would be worthwhile.
Given what the president has set out for us to do, if we are able to do it, the world will judge it as a good thing, that it is the way that will ensure that Iran cannot acquire a nuclear weapon, and no other pathway will get us there.
In Riyadh, Kerry and Saudi officials will discuss regional unrest, including the U.S.-led coalition efforts to fight the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria. The talks come on the heels of a White House summit on combating violent extremism, where Kerry spoke at a ministerial conference.
Terror is their obsession. It's what they do. And if we let them, their singleness of purpose could actually wind up giving them a comparative advantage.
Middle East Institute analyst Paul Salem says the coalition's progress in fighting the militants has been uneven, with better results in Iraq than in Syria.
The fact that ISIS has an enormous sanctuary in Syria, yes, makes the fight in Iraq harder because they have ability to retreat into Syria and then regroup and attack again.
Kerry wraps up his week in London, where he will meet with Gulf Arab ministers to discuss shared regional concerns. Pam Dawkins, VOA News, the State Department.
An Iraqi coalition of government troops and militias has begun a highly publicized offensive to push Islamic State militants out of the city of Tikrit. Prime Minister Haider al-Abadi announced the start of the operation Sunday as he traveled to nearby Samarra to oversee the efforts to liberate Tikrit. Mr. Abadi called on Sunni tribal fighters to abandon the Islamic State group. He offered what he called the last chance for Sunni tribal fighters, promising them a pardon. Tikrit had been under Islamic State control since mid-2014. In Egypt, a bomb detonated near a police station and a mosque in the southern city of Aswan, killing at least two people, wounding several others late on Sunday. Meanwhile, Egypt's parliamentary elections may be delayed after a court ruled part of the country's election law dealing with electoral districts was unconstitutional. First phase of the elections was to take place on March 22nd. It is the final step of a political transition put in place by the army following the ouster of President Mohamed Morsi in July of 2013. The country has been without a parliament since June of 2012, when a court dissolved the last parliament. President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi has ordered the law to be redrafted within a month.
Visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com.
voanews.com.
Online news for a changing world.
In the Democratic Republic of Congo, at least seven Rwandan rebels of the Democratic Front, Forces for the Liberation of Rwanda, the FDLR, been killed with others captured along with territory and weapons in a government offensive in the country's southeast. That offensive began last week against rebels in North and South Kivu provinces. Estimated 1,500 to 2,000 Hutu rebels have been active in eastern DRC since the Rwandan genocide of 1994. A crowd beat to death a girl suspected of being a suicide bomber. They also set her body ablaze, all of this happening in the northeastern Nigerian city of Bauchi on Sunday. She was one of two girls who refused to be searched when they arrived at the gate to a vegetable market. The second girl was arrested. It comes following a series of suicide incidents and bombings in communities across northern Nigeria, many of them carried out by girls and blamed on the Islamist militant group Boko Haram. Mali's government Sunday signed a preliminary peace deal with some of the country's northern separatist groups in Algiers, but the main Tuareg rebel alliance has asked for more time for consultations before agreeing to the accord. It follows 8 months of negotiations. Malian Foreign Affairs Minister Abdoulaye Diop says the venue of Algiers was the right choice for the talks. He says the crisis in the country is decreasing slowly but surely. Formal signing ceremony expected in Bamako later this month. The UN brokered deal is aimed at ending decades of instability in northern Mali. Tuareg rebel groups are seeking autonomy for the region. Recent fighting and the political status of the desert north have delayed that agreement. Mali has been unstable since Tuareg fighters launched a new insurgency at the start of 2012, an event that triggered a coup in Bamako, a takeover of the north by Islamist militants, and the intervention of French and African forces in early 2013. Sierra Leone's vice president has put himself in quarantine for 21 days after one of his bodyguards died of Ebola. Sam Sumana becomes the highest-ranking African official to be in quarantine. His decision comes as the West African country reimposes travel restrictions amid a rise in new cases of the deadly virus. The country recorded 18 new cases of Ebola in the week ending Saturday, reversing a recent decline. More than 9,500 have died of Ebola since the outbreak began a year ago. Liberian President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf met with President Obama at the White House on Friday. She says with Ebola cases in her country on the decline, the crisis, though, has not yet passed.
Even though 13 of our 15 political subdivisions have now
you know, have zero new cases. And even though we feel confident that we're getting to the place where we can really say we can confront and we can beat this disease, but we know we're not there yet. We're not there because we are still in a region where there are a few others affected countries, two others. They have not reached the level of success and progress that we have, but we know that we all remain under threat until all of us have reached a place where we get to zero.
She thanked the U.S. military for their role in building treatment facilities to treat Ebola patients. That role in Liberia officially ended on Thursday. Meanwhile, American nurse Nina Pham told the Dallas Morning News Sunday she plans to file a lawsuit today against Texas Health Resources. That's the parent company of Texas Health Presbyterian Hospital, where she worked and contracted Ebola while treating Liberian Thomas Eric Duncan, who died while in the United States. 26-year-old nurse says she continues to suffer from body aches and insomnia and blames a lack of training and proper equipment as well as violations of her privacy. UN aid agencies are increasing operations in flood-stricken Malawi in a desperate attempt to stave off a potentially large-scale cholera epidemic. Lisa Schlein has more from the UN offices in Geneva.
UN aid workers are alarmed at the prospect of a large nationwide outbreak of cholera in Malawi. This is because the disease is located in the southern border areas where flood victims are living in overcrowded camps, an environment in which cholera flourishes. The last time the country experienced a large-scale outbreak was in 2009, when well over 1,000 people were infected. The UN Children's Fund says it is concerned something similar might happen now, as Malawi, which was hit by devastating floods in January, is short of adequate water and sanitation. The Ministry of Health reports 39 confirmed cases of cholera, including two deaths over a two-week period. UNICEF spokesman Christophe Bouliérac tells VOA, the situation is particularly alarming because all cases of cholera in Malawi are directly linked to another outbreak of the disease in neighboring Mozambique. And, he adds, the number of cases there appears to be on the increase.
Lisa, the situation is much more serious in Mozambique regarding cholera. And what is at stake now in Malawi is to respond in order to avoid a propagation of cholera in Malawi. The capacity of response of health services in Malawi, the problem of access, are very worrying, and all the partners are in the process to scale up their response.
The United Nations reports Mozambique has recorded more than 3,400 cholera cases and 37 deaths since December 25th, many of them children. People who become infected with cholera experience diarrhea, vomiting, and in the later stages, severe dehydration. If not properly treated, cholera can kill within hours and is especially dangerous for young children. UNICEF is providing mobile health services in Malawi in addition to safe water, sanitation, and hygiene services. All are critical in preventing the spread of cholera. Aid workers, however, are facing a problem of access to the victims because the floods have washed away bridges and roads. This could seriously hamper efforts to contain this deadly disease. The January floods are the worst on record in Malawi. The UN reports some 230,000 people still are displaced as the rains continue and more than 170 people are missing. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Earlier results of Lesotho's snap election show Prime Minister Thomas Thabane eking an early lead with about 25% of the votes counted. Saturday's poll, called 2 years ahead of schedule, appeared to go off without any incidents. The Democratic Congress, led by former Prime Minister Pagalitha Mosisili, has come in second. Lesotho has a mixed election system based on voting district results and the popular vote to determine how to apportion the parliament's 120 seats. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon, in a statement, welcomed the peaceful parliamentary election, calling it an important step in Lesotho's return to political normalcy. Small Mountain Kingdom in southern Africa has been in crisis since last June when Mr. Thabane was suspended parliament after his coalition government splintered. In August, soldiers attacked police headquarters, looting weapons and killing one officer. Mr. Tabani accused the army of a coup and fled to South Africa. The opposition and military have denied there was any coup attempt.
News is mobile, and so are you. Get VOA on the go. Get VOA on Google Currents. Get VOA News specifically made for your tablet and smartphone. Clean, simple, fast. Now available for Android or Apple phones or tablets. Download the Google Currents app for free today. Get VOA on Google Currents at voanews.com/currents.
And in U.S. politics, Republicans who are considering a run for president next year have been spending some time recently looking for support at the annual Conservative Political Action Conference going on just outside Washington. CPAC, as the conference is known, brings together thousands of conservative activists from around the country and is considered an early test of the potential Republican presidential field. VOA national correspondent Jim Malone has our report.
Among those testing the political waters at the CPAC conference was Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker. Walker has surged in some early polls and is critical of President Barack Obama's approach to dealing with the Islamic State.
We need a president, a leader, who will stand up and say we will take the fight to them and not wait till they bring the fight to American soil for our children and our grandchildren.
Former Florida Governor Jeb Bush is also near the top of the early polls, but has plenty of conservative critics. He said Republicans must reach out to minority voters.
If we share our enthusiasm and love for our country and belief in our philosophy, we will be able to get Latinos and young people and other people that you need to win to get 50.
Kentucky Senator Rand Paul was an exception on foreign policy, warning against extended U.S. military involvement abroad.
I envision an America with a national defense unparalleled, undefeatable, and unencumbered by nation building.
Another conservative favorite, Texas Senator Ted Cruz, focused on President Obama's executive actions on immigration.
If a candidate says they oppose President Obama's illegal and unconstitutional executive amnesty, terrific. When have you stood up and fought against it?
Conservative activist Renee Cannon from South Carolina took part in a straw poll or test vote for the potential contenders, and there was little doubt about her preference.
Ted Cruz, I think it's kind of obvious. I think he's principled. I think he's a man of conviction.
Apart from the speeches and campaigning, the conference is a chance for conservatives to bond, says Scotty Nell Hughes of the Tea Party News Network.
We need to come in and get beefed up and say, yes, you're not alone in this world being conservative. So from that perspective, yes, from a morale, you've got to have these conferences because we get beat down in the world so much. You come here and you're like, okay, I'm ready to go fight.
Contenders who make a good impression at the conference can gain an advantage, says Washington Post political reporter Dan Valls.
What happens here goes well beyond these corridors, and a lot of people will be watching. So I think all of the people who are coming who have their eye on running for president know they want to do well here.
The CPAC conference is an early test in what promises to be a long and hard-fought campaign for the Republican presidential nomination. Jim Malone, VOA News, Washington.
And as for that straw poll that Jim just mentioned at the CPAC conference, turned out that Rand Paul was the top choice of the people who attended it for the Republican Party nomination. Scott Walker was in at number two. Jeb Bush was number five. Well, a husband and wife married 82 years, that's right, 82 years, thought to be one of the oldest married couples in New York, are celebrating their birthdays. They did it over the weekend. Their combined ages, 212. Durinord Velliard turned 108 on Saturday. His wife, Jean Velliard, won't turn. Her birthday's in May, but she's 105. Many of the Velliard's seven grandchildren, 12 great-grandchildren, all kinds of people, great-great-grandchildren, just tons of people showed up at the couple's home. Yes, they still live on their own. Couple married in November 1932, the same month that Franklin Roosevelt was elected President of the United States. Velliard is a native of Haiti. where he was a judge. In the United States, he worked as a hospital laboratory technician. They moved here in 1968. Many thanks, everyone, for joining us here on the Voice of America for International Edition. A reminder, the top world news is straight ahead. Hope you'll stay tuned. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Dave Magnus, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. Have a great Monday.
This is Today in History. On March 2nd, 1836, the Republic of Texas declared its independence from Mexico. That date also was the 43rd birthday of Sam Houston, who was the first president of Texas. In 1882, Queen Victoria narrowly escaped an assassination attempt. On this day in 1901, the United States Congress passed the Platt Amendment. That limited the autonomy of Cuba as a condition for the withdrawal of American troops from the island. The man who was perhaps the 20th century's most famous author for children was born on this day in 1904. Theodore Geisel introduced us to such famous characters as the Cat in the Hat and the Grinch who stole Christmas. We better remember Theodore Geisel by his pen name, Dr. Seuss. In 1917, the Russian Revolution was set into motion with the abdication of the last Tsar, Nicholas II. On this day in 1933, the classic movie about the giant ape known as King Kong had its premiere in New York City. In 1946, Ho Chi Minh was elected president of Vietnam. In 1956, Morocco gained its independence from France. In 1959, Miles Davis held the first of two recording sessions that resulted in the album Kind of Blue. In 1962, an army led by General Ne Win seized power in Burma. Also on this day in 1962, Philadelphia Warriors center Wilt Chamberlain scored 100 points in a basketball game against the New York Knicks. That game was played in Hershey, Pennsylvania, where only 4,000 turned out to see the greatest individual scoring performance in NBA history. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Long torn by clan rivalries, stricken by drought and resulting famine, and attacks by a militant extremist group, the East African nation of Somalia has made important strides since completing its political transition in 2012. In a nation once synonymous with chaos, there are hopeful signs of improved security and economic growth. Throughout the process, the United States has stood with the Somali people, providing security, governance, and humanitarian assistance to help strengthen democratic institutions and improve stability. Recognizing Somalia's progress, and as a sign of our nation's deepening relationship with Somalia, President Barack Obama has nominated Catherine S. Denani, a veteran diplomat, as U.S. ambassador to Somalia. It's a critical step towards normalizing the U.S.-Somalia bilateral relationship, since our recognition of the federal government of Somalia in January 2013. Since our embassy closed in 1991 amid the country's then growing instability, the United States conducted diplomacy on Somalia affairs based out of Nairobi. Over the past 5 years, the United States began to travel more frequently into Somalia to conduct official business. When security conditions permit, it is envisioned that an embassy will be reestablished in Mogadishu. While Somalia has come far in the last 2 years, many challenges and threats remain. The Al-Qaeda-linked terrorists Al-Shabaab have been weakened, but not defeated. Government services are uneven, and tens of thousands of Somalis remain displaced from their homes by violence. To keep making progress, the pivotal task for Somalia will not be securing more aid from the United States and other international partners, but for its leaders to put their loyalties and differences behind them and commit to working together for the common good.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.